I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 156 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. We've got a special one for you this week as Chef Grant Achatz of the 3-Michelin-star restaurant Alinea and I talk about someone we knew in common, the late chef Charlie Trotter. In August 1987, the restaurant Charlie Trotter's opened in Chicago's Lincoln Park neighborhood, and it changed the way people in Chicago and beyond dined. Trotter closed his restaurant after 25 years in August 2012, and he died in November the following year from a stroke at age 54. Now, Chef Achatz is paying tribute to Trotter and his food with the Charlie Trotter menu at Achatz's Chicago restaurant Next, which takes on a new format every 4 months. The Trotter menu at Next runs through January 12th. Achatz says he's, quote, paying homage to a chef who had massive impact internationally on gastronomy, but never, in my opinion, had enough credit for all the innovations that he started. Charlie Trotter's anticipated the farm-to-table movement by sourcing fresh, often unusual ingredients from small purveyors. It dispensed with heavy French-style sauces in favor of lighter, healthier broths. It offered bold, surprising flavor and texture combinations. It created lavish tasting menus, including some spotlighting vegetables, and it elevated wine pairings. The mercurial, ever-demanding Trotter led his front and back-of-the-house staffs on an obsessive quest to merge food, wine, service, and hospitality into a singular, sublime experience. As a result, Charlie Trotter's was among the world's most celebrated and honored restaurants. Trotter compared himself to a jazz musician, saying he never made the same dish twice. Yet he broke ground with his beautiful cookbooks, among the first to function as coffee table art books. They also worked as recruiting tools for chefs such as 21-year-old Achatz, who was working in a hotel restaurant in Grand Rapids, Michigan, when he bombarded Trotter with letters stating his desire to work there. After passing a test involving a mystery box of ingredients, Achatz wound up working in Trotter's kitchen for only a few months in 1995. It was not a positive experience. Achatz moved on to a much longer tutelage under Chef Thomas Keller at the French Laundry in Napa Valley. Achatz explains why that experience worked for him in a way that the one at Trotter's did not. Achatz moved back to the Chicago area to run the kitchen at Trio in Evanston, and then, with partner Nick Kokonis, to build out his own place, Alinea. It opened in May 2005, less than half a mile from Trotter's. Achatz mixed molecular gastronomy techniques with his classic training and highly creative mind to take the fine dining experience to yet another level. Achatz and Trotter had what Achatz calls an aggressively competitive relationship, with Trotter disparaging his modern approach in the New York Times. But when Michelin first awarded stars to Chicago restaurants in 2011, Alinea received the most coveted 3, while Trotter's received 2. Trotter closed his restaurant a year later.
My philosophy has always been, if it weren't for employees and if it weren't for the customers, the restaurant business would be the greatest business in the world. And basically, I hate people. So, but you can't put that out there.
Right? No, Writer-director Rebecca Halpern made an excellent, multifaceted documentary about Chef Trotter called Love, Charlie, which is now showing on Netflix. Both Grant Achatz and I are in it. I wrote about Trotter numerous times for the Chicago Tribune, including his restaurant's ban on foie gras that prompted the city of Chicago to follow suit, temporarily, though Trotter opposed such government action. The first 2 words in my book, The Foie Gras Wars, are Charlie Trotter. In this insightful, revealing conversation, Chef Achatz reflects on his long, complicated relationship with Charlie Trotter, including ways in which he has come to relate to the way his former boss ran a kitchen. Achatz also takes us through the creation of the Next Charlie Trotter menu, identifying dishes that he'd worked on during his brief stint at the restaurant. If you've eaten this menu, and if you haven't, you'll want to hear about courses such as the carrot and potato cannelloni, a sneaky standout of the evening. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation about Charlie Trotter with Chef Grant Achatz. So Next, your restaurant has 4 months of doing the Charlie Trotter menu, where you guys are basically recreating an evening at Charlie Trotter's.
Right.
What was the impetus for you to do that?
Well, you know, it was really about paying homage to, you know, a chef that had a massive impact internationally on gastronomy. but never, in my opinion, got enough credit for all the innovations that he sort of started. I mean, my parents, even the tasting menu, the use of vegetables and not heavily reduced sauces, he really was sort of revolutionary. And maybe it was because he was from Chicago and wasn't in New York or Paris that he probably didn't get the credit that he deserved. But, you know, I felt it was important for him, his legacy, in some weird way, our relationship and the city of Chicago.
What was the weird way of your relationship?
Well, you know, it was complicated, right? So when I worked there in 1995, it wasn't the best fit for me. I was 21 years old. That kitchen was by far the most intense that I had ever experienced. At that point, I hadn't, you know, I had no experience, but probably in the entire world, that was probably one of the hardest. 17-hour days, really, really physical cooking and scrubbing, under a tremendous amount of pressure, to be the best restaurant in the world. And under his management style, which was really, really demanding to attempt to achieve that best restaurant status, it was a lot, especially at that age. So, you know, as the years went on, I opened Alinea, and him and I started to repair what was sort of a, I wouldn't even call it fractured, because we never really had a relationship to start. We'll call it aggressively competitive. How about
Right,
that?
sure.
And so there was that notion when we opened Alinea, and I'm sure he felt a little bit threatened, that there was a new contender in the city that wanted to dethrone him. And so it wasn't long after we opened that we started talking again, and he was really generous with his time and words, right before, you know, right up until he passed. And so I felt like, for me, a person that believes in second chances and kind of letting water go under the bridge, even though he was gone, I felt like it was a fitting way to put a cherry on the top of a very misunderstood and
Right.
complicated relationship. Yeah.
So 1995, you're 21. Are you in Michigan at that point?
So yeah, I just graduated culinary school and was working in Grand Rapids at a big hotel in Michigan.
So of all the places that you wanted to work, what drove you to Charlie Trotter's?
So I did a big, big nationwide search and was flipping through like Wine Spectator magazine and Gourmet. That was back when, you know, print media was the most reliable source of information, right? No social media back then. And after looking into his food, paging through his first book, it was really apparent that his food was very different. It wasn't classic French, even though you could find that foundation in there. It was new and it was innovative and it was unusual. And I think all of those things resonated with my personality. I was always really curious.
Yeah, something that's fascinating to me about Trotter's is that on one hand, he maintained, you know, he was open for 25 years, and it's like, you know, like a jazz musician, you know, we're not going for perfection, we're going for excellence, and we're going to change it up every night. Like
Right.
no Miles Davis solo is the same every night, and no menu is the same every night. The
Right.
dishes aren't the same every night. Yet he really kind of put on the map the cookbook, right? Like the sort of the like that first Charlie Trotter cookbook, I think had a big influence on young chefs. And so like the idea of still, you know, immortalizing some of those dishes, it got you in there, right?
Yeah. I mean, that first book, the photos were unlike anything that was in a cookbook at that time. Even the layout with the full page bleed of the dish, often zoomed in really tight on the components, which led it to kind of coming off with a lot of mystery or intrigue. And then the anecdotal paragraph on the other side of the page, right above the recipe, that kind of was the brain dump, if you will, or, you know, that intellectual kind of articulation of why that came together, that was also really new. And who doesn't like to pull back the curtain and figure out how the magician is doing the trick, right?
Right.
So as a young culinarian, it was beautiful. It was new, innovative, and there were elements of education that wasn't present really at that time.
Did you cook from that cookbook when you were home?
I didn't cook from it at home, but I brought it into where I was working at the time in Grand Rapids and replicated a lot of those dishes and put them on the menu.
But really?
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah. The chef that was running that particular restaurant was really supportive and encouraged me to replicate them because I was so in awe at what they look like. And stylistically, the way that they use Asian ingredients and Indian ingredients, that he was like, you should make them and see how they taste.
Huh.
You know, they look beautiful.
Right.
They sound really creative, but how they taste. And so we would make them and put them on as a special.
Would you say like Charlie Trotter's blank, or you just said it was your own adaptation of it? When you finally made them, did they taste as good as they looked? Was there anything surprising about how they tasted?
They tasted foreign. Not at that point in my life, not good or bad, because there was no benchmark. So you couldn't evaluate it like I was used to with French food. It was very obvious if a technique was wrong or something, the ratios were off of the components. This was so new, it was hard to know whether it was right or wrong.
Huh.
And that was exciting, honestly.
Do you remember any of the dishes in particular you were putting up?
Not specifically then. It wasn't until later when I worked at the restaurant that it became like embedded in my brain, because then you had all of the tools of evaluating and memory, and they just really got pushed in, you know?
Yeah.
And that would become really powerful for me later when we are recreating a lot of these dishes, because I remember them. So that first smell of the carrot cardamom sauce on the cannelloni is that transported me back, you know, to 1995 instantly.
Was that a dish you made when you were there?
That was on my station, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That was one of the ones that popped out at me. I mean, they were all really great, but that was like, I was going to tell you that if there's any sleeper, it was that one.
Yeah, for sure the sleeper, right?
Because it was just, I just remember being like, oh, this is just like so flavorful. And I had like the raisins in it, right? And just these sort of sweet and savory elements and just like the combination of everything. And it was a veg dish that just was, you know, just was so silky and just delicious.
And that was another example of his humor and his wit and his creative process. Like, now we take it for granted. Like, something can be something made from something else, right? So
right.
You have, I don't know. I mean, in that case, it was a cannelloni, but it wasn't dessert, and it wasn't made out of pastry. It was made out of potato. So, like, there was a lot of riffing going on of taking something that existed and flipping it right over on its head. which I read that book, and I when I finally ate his food, I was like, wow, this is really intelligent.
So you put that cannelloni together on your station that
Every night.
was it the summer of 95
It
or?
was, yeah. Yeah, summer into fall.
So when you walked into that kitchen for the first time, like what was your impression?
It felt like I just stepped into a rodeo and they shut the gate behind me. It was at the same time, there was fear. The pace was a sprint all the time. People were also very excited, and the passion was really flowing through that restaurant because you noticed that there was such teamwork with the ambition to make this as perfect as we could under unbelievably adverse conditions, in that you were tired, you were hungry. You had 150, 180 people coming in that night.
It's a lot.
That's a lot for that style of food,
Yeah.
right? And you knew that Charlie would be at the pass, like in some ways, depending on his mood, trying to push that team beyond the limit. And there was a lot of intrepidation, there was a lot of anxiety because nobody knew when it would break or who would break it. And so there was a tremendous amount of teamwork, and there was a lot of protective actions by the like Matthias and Bill Kim and Giuseppe. They were really good at knowing the pressures that everybody was on and knowing the responsibility as being managers in that kitchen. They would like every day they would jump in front of the train in order to protect the hooks.
Right.
And I always really admired that. That was something that normally wouldn't happen. And it just showed leadership.
Yeah.
The really mature leadership.
When you had that first day, how much had you interacted with Charlie at that point?
So prior to showing up for my stage, I wrote him a letter every day for about 2 weeks, of which he never responded. And obviously, I expected to never hear from him.
What did you say in your letters?
How ambitious I was, my family background, how I'd been cooking since I was six, and but also kind of clouded with being humble and telling him straight away that, I was really inexperienced and didn't know what fine dining was, but had this really strong ambition to understand it.
Yeah.
Complimented him a lot about having the best restaurant in the country. And after about a month, I came home from work one night, and this is back when there were actual answering machines, right? And he left a message. And I was thrilled, obviously. It took me about 2 weeks to get him on the phone. That was back when there was also
Right.
landlines. And so there was a kitchen line that I would call every day, sometimes twice a day, trying to catch him in the kitchen. And most of the time it would be Bill Kim or Matthias, and they'd be like, nope, call back tomorrow. Nope, call back tomorrow. And I would, and finally got him on the phone, and he invited me to come down to Chicago for a 2 day tryout. And I think it was like a week later, I drove down.
What did he say on your answering machine?
He has a very distinct voice and cadence to his speech. So it was something like, I think he called me Chef, which was really disarming at the time. Chef Grant, I received all of your letters. I appreciate your persistence Because of that, we'd like to invite you down for a 2-day tryout.
Nice.
Here's the contact for my HR person. You can schedule it with them. And that was it.
And little did you know at that point that he was like this famous letter postcard writer.
Right.
You know, which you learn about in Rebecca Halpern's documentary, Love, Charlie, which you and I are both in. And I've seen some of the letters he'd sent to some other people, but like these. So yeah, expressing yourself with your words is actually probably, you didn't realize that would especially connect with him, maybe.
Yeah, right. And at the end of our relationship, he would write me frequently. And with congratulations on, a review in the Tribune or 5 mobile stars or whatever the accolade was.
So this is like when you were back like a Trio or Open
No,
Alinea?
This was here. This was at Alinea.
Okay.
After we hit some milestones.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you did your 2 days and then they told you, okay, you passed the audition.
Yeah.
What did they have you doing on those 2 days?
So the first day was just a lot of observation and prep. And then day two, we had a mystery box. So Matthias and Bill Kim put together literally a box. I think they emptied out a tomato box from Tom Corneo, who would deliver produce twice a day. And they filled it with a bunch of random ingredients and said, you have 3 hours to cook 4 courses and you have to serve them to chef.
It's like a little chop to the episode.
Yeah.
Four chops.
Back before then. Yeah, right. So I did it and I felt really, really good about it. And apparently it was good enough because
I remember what you made.
I remember some of it. I had some poached salmon, chanterelle mushrooms, baby carrots. So not too far off, actually, than a dish that is on the menu right now at Next. The only difference was we are using Chilean sea bass and I use salmon. I never thought of that until just this second. I did a panna cotta for dessert, not the Nancy Silverton one that's on the menu now, but it was a panna cotta. And I think I did a zucchini soup. It was nerve-wracking.
Was he sitting at a table in the restaurant when nobody was in there? Was he kind of in the back in the kitchen somewhere?
No, so he had an office in the building right next door.
Right, because you had the two townhouses connected.
Yeah, and so I had to waft the plate over, go outside the front of the restaurant, come in the entry, and then he was at his desk. And I would have to sit down and describe it and then go start on the next dish.
Wow.
Yeah. Petrified, right? I mean, my desire to work there at that point was through the roof. It was like, this is it or nothing. I didn't know. I didn't have a next move if I didn't get hired. So there was a lot of eggs in that basket and I wanted it really bad. So I just put my head down and focus, and the whole time he would not show any emotion. There was no hint on whether he liked the dish or not.
Like when you were serving him this
yeah.
thing. Was it like lunch that you were doing?
It was lunch. Okay. Yeah. And when I would come back in to drop the next course, the previous course was gone.
Right.
I don't know where it went.
That's a good sign, but, presumably.
But I couldn't evaluate because I didn't know how much he had eaten off the plate. They weren't on his desk anymore. So it was nerve-wracking.
Also, the plate itself was gone. Yeah. It wasn't like there was like just like this plate where it looked like he'd licked the plate or something.
The entire plate. And again, I feel like that's very indicative of his management style and personality where he kept you off balance. You never felt steady on your feet. And, it was years and years later after having Alinea for a couple of years where I started to understand the methodology of that and the way that psychological sort of manipulation could be a positive thing.
Right.
At the time, I was like, this is mental. Like, this is not helping my ability to cook. And that part was probably true, but it was building fortitude and a skill set that, you know, I would come to find out was very valuable.
So, I mean, there's certainly, there came a point where you were like, you know what, this isn't for me. What was that point? And how long had you been there at that point?
Oh man, I think I was only there like 4 months. It was devastating, honestly. It was, because like I said, that at that moment in time, that restaurant was the pinnacle. And for me, it was a test. Should I hang at that level? You know, up until that point, it was mostly my family's diner and then this little stint at a hotel restaurant. So I felt like it was a big failure for me personally and really clouded my path forward. I didn't really know. And so if this was the best restaurant and I wasn't good enough, then what? What, go to the second best restaurant? Go to the third best? Like, it all became very murky to
right.
me. And so, you know, I was sad, I was frustrated, I was angry, and I blamed it on the restaurant and the chef, right? So I was convinced that I was fine and it was the restaurant's fault, and that if I went out and found another restaurant that was as good or better, maybe I would be better at it. And that actually turned out to be the case.
I was going to say that you actually did do that with the French Laundry.
Yeah.
But what was the end of your experience at Trotter's? Like, how did that end?
I tried to give notice a couple of times. And the first time, Matthias said no. The second time, Bill said no. And, you know, these are about 2 week intervals, right? And so after Matthias said no the first time, I was like, all right, I'm going to put my head down and really try to do this. And it was the same cycle. The first week I was on fire, and then something would happen. I would stumble and be like, ah, I can't quite do this. And so it was that way for about a month. And then finally I went up to them and I'm like, chefs, it's not happening. And they were understanding, and they're like, well, you have to go tell the man. And so I walked over there to his office once again and explained to him how I knew for a fact that I wasn't performing at the highest level that I could. And I felt like I was letting everybody down. Because again, going back to what I said previously, that restaurant, you were on the tight wire, and at any given moment, any misstep from anyone on that team resulted in the entire service just failing. So as individuals, we all had such a large amount of pressure because we didn't want to let anyone else down. And I think it was that pressure and the consistency of me making stupid mistakes. I was like, I just shouldn't be here. Like, I'm causing more frustration and anguish from the team than I have to. So,
like, what's an example of a mistake you were making?
Silly mistakes, probably mistakes that nobody would ever notice, like roasting hazelnuts and then storing them under refrigeration. Or pulling a plate off a shelf for a VIP that those particular plates were designated for VIPs, so they wouldn't get used that often, and so they accumulated some dust. And I would pull it down. It was for somebody that Chef Trotter really wanted to impress, and I would plate the food on it, but it would be full of dust. And
I mean, it was probably not that much dust because you would have noticed if it was like coated with dust.
But. Right. But any dust.
But there's a little bit of dust. And right. So did Chef Trotter come by and say, look, there's this dust on here, man?
Yeah. I mean, he would run his finger across the plate and then hold his finger up to your face. And in that particular case, that was it. Nothing was said. It was just known. In fact, it was more powerful than saying anything. So yeah, it was time. It was time.
And was there a lot of yelling in that kitchen? Like, were you getting yelled at, or was it more,
you know,
internal?
For as much as people talk about the intensity, and in some ways the toxicity of that restaurant, there wasn't a lot of yelling. There was a lot of mind games.
Right.
That, again, probably more, way more effective than yelling. Because that restaurant was number one, and everybody was there for that reason. And if you, it didn't matter how you felt, what you were going through, you were dedicating everything you had to that restaurant at that time. So some of that mental, you know, hardship that you endured, it was just known that that was part of being in a place that was striving to be the best. That was the currency.
Did anyone pull you aside and give you a pep talk at some point and say, hey, you know, look, it's just a mistake. You're taking it too hard. Just shrug it off. Move on to the next one.
Every day, twice a day, three times a day, you know? And
so do you feel like you were internally just like so mad at yourself for making mistakes? Or do you feel like you were really kind of getting badgered out of there?
No, I definitely wasn't badgered out. In fact, really, really trying to be persuaded into staying. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I would look around that kitchen and I knew that I was fine. I was just fine. I wasn't egregiously worse than anyone. I wasn't head and shoulders above anyone. I was average. And at that time, average was very, very, very acceptable. Because it was such a pressure cooker,
right?
That there was a tremendous amount of attrition. Like the back door was opening and closing every day. 3 or 4 people would leave every day. And then the next day, 5 people would start. And it was that cycle, that revolving door all the time. All the
Interesting.
Time. It was like speed dating, if you will. Like, you know, you would come in and try to see if it was a good fit, and then if it wasn't, you were out.
While you were working there, is that when you started having visions of if you were running a kitchen, what you would do with it and the kind of food you'd want to put out, or was that too early for that?
Yeah, that was a little too early for that. That would come later at the French Laundry. Yeah.
Right.
I was hell-bent on learning. And again, I was only 21, so very impressionable, very malleable, very eyes wide open. And so that was another thing for me, like why it made leaving so hard, because I was so young and inexperienced. I just thought that this is what all restaurants at this level are like. I didn't know that there are other personalities. So the personal defeat was one thing, but then going like, oh no, what did I get myself into with this profession?
Right. You know? Thinking it's indicative of what life in restaurants is
like. Yeah. And largely, especially in the 90s, it was, you know, at that top 1%, you know, Les Panache, Danielle, Le Bernardin, the French Laundry. Those were the top of the top. And in order to achieve that, it was pretty militant. It was pretty black and white.
When you went to talk to the man and tell Trotter you were going, what was that conversation?
He tried to talk me out of it for a while.
Was he complimentary at that point?
Yeah. Yeah. Not effusive, but anything from him at that point. That was the Midas touch. So anything that he said that was favorable had a lot of impact. And at one point, he had me. Like, he pulled me back in, and I went home. So I told him, yeah, I'll stay. And then I went home, came back the next day. He was not there that day. So then another week went by, and then I got in front of him again, very, very sheepishly and head down, no eye contact, and was like, you know, said something like, my lease is coming up, my short-term lease, and I don't want to extend it, so I'm going to leave.
Had anything happened in that week to kind of solidify that idea since he'd convinced you to come back?
I mean, just the normal events.
Anxiety level, yeah, and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was a weird time.
So did he say something to you like, all right, you can never use me as a reference. You're, you know,
yeah,
you're no longer a Trotter alum or whatever.
Right. He did. I also think that's very typical of that period. And I remember even when we opened here at Alinea, I would not outwardly say that, but definitely act that way. And, you know, there's a lot of chefs that worked here for a very long time that I don't speak to. And I wish that wasn't the case. But, you know, when you're so dedicated and so passionate and your restaurant becomes so woven into the fabric of your identity that you yourself cannot separate them.
It's his name.
Yeah, but even me, like, you feel betrayed when people right. leave. You feel unwanted. It's the same thing when somebody breaks up with you. You feel, like, hurt and betrayed and angry. And so I understand his actions of saying, like, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you never worked here, you know. I've done the same without saying it, you know, in the past. And I'm not happy about that.
And these are with people sometimes who worked there a long time.
Yeah. You know, there's a couple of chefs that have worked for us for, I mean, they were here 7, 8, 10 years. And the pressures are hard. They're emotionally heavy.
I mean, is that because, I mean, were they leaving because it's like, look, I just want to do my own thing. I want to open my own place. And then you have my blessing. But, or was it more like there was like a conflict that led them to leave? And that's why it felt like a more difficult thing.
I can't remember any instances where there was a conflict. I mean, when you were here for 5 years, it feels like 15. You know, if you're here for 10, it feels like 100. You know, and people's lives change. They get married. They have children. They realize that they don't want to work 75 hours a week. And, you know, in that particular, in those examples, when you have people that are of similar age to you, even though you're the chef, you're the owner, you're the boss, there's a friendship there. There's a brotherhood in these particular cases that make it really hard to separate, because you're working almost 80 hours a week together, side by side, chasing the impossible, and also going through hardship together, like bad services, long hours, but also some of the highest highs.
Right.
Like when you're able to create something like the balloon or the hot potato, cold potato, or the dessert on the table, those collaborations they're amazing. And to not have the opportunity to have that collaboration, that dialogue with people that have been with you for 10 years that you trust, That's a hard pill to swallow.
You've had the best restaurant in Chicago for many years now. Mm-hmm. So you've been in, you felt that pressure that he was feeling, and you probably, you know, over the course of time thought, oh, I get where he was coming from more than you did at the time when you were 21.
Yeah. I mean, that part was really shocking to me. How in that moment, and this has happened everywhere, every place I've been, especially at Shrouders and the French Laundry, where you have no idea. You're a mind fuck, right? You have no idea the nuances, the complexities, the amount of decision making that the chef or owner has to make on a daily basis. Nor should you. That's not your job. But when you become the chef or owner, and you're able to look back at the way Chef Teller behaved and the way Chef Schroeder behaved, there's a light bulb moment, and you're like, oh, I was mad back then. I was pissed off at them for acting that way. Now I'm doing the same thing, and I understand why.
Right.
It's powerful.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the premium lager Cold Time, and the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero. Hero IPA variety packs are available so you can enjoy Anti-Hero, Infinity Hero, Hazy Hero, and West Coast Hero side by side. And now you can get DDH Colada Hero, a hazy double IPA laden with a classic swizzle of coconut and pineapple notes. Was there like a period of time in where you sort of reassessed everything, or did you just go right back in and like, all right, what are the other best restaurants? Oh, there's French Laundry. That's a good
one. Yeah. I was so lost, and my confidence was squished. But also, again, I recognized that I was super young. I'd only been out of culinary school about 8 months at this point. So I had optimism, and because of my culinary school background that was rooted in French, I thought, well, if I thought this was the best in the U.S., and everybody talks about Joël Robuchon and Alain Ducasse and Freddy Girardet, I have to go to France and find out what the real restaurants are like. That's what I was telling myself. And it turns out that they weren't that good, which was simultaneously shocking and also even more disheartening because...
Were you staging in these places or just visiting?
Visiting, but being very observant. So a lot of them had open kitchens that you could look in, and it was pretty obvious what was happening back there. Probably more intense and rougher than Trotter's was. And so, you know, I was 3 months in Europe, came home and was like, great, now what? You know? And then picked up the magazines and tried to find something else that was a better fit. And that's how I wound up in Napa.
You get to the French Laundry and you're under Chef Thomas Keller. How is that kitchen different from what you'd experienced at Trotter's?
So, a couple of things. French Laundry had only been open 2 years before I started. Trotter's was open almost 10 at that point. I think they opened in 87.
Yeah, I was going to say 87, so it would have been 8 years
when
you got
8 years.
There.
So, that 5 or 6 year period, there's a lot of growth, there's a lot of maturing, and there is a different type of momentum that fuels the restaurant. So at Trotter's, they were very much already in the thick of it, of being known as one of the best restaurants in the world. And everything was set up. The restaurant was set up beautifully. Immaculate kitchen, all brand new pots and pans. There was no expense that was left on the table. At the French Laundry, it was still, it was a kid in elementary school, right? Mm. You weren't fully that, you didn't have the nice clothes, you know, you weren't quarterback on the football team yet. It was in its infancy. And so what happens in that environment is everybody's sort of on the same playing field, and you grow and are participating in the accolades and the achievement and the creativity and the team building all together as a family. So you don't feel like you're thrown into something that's already existing. And
you were helping to build, not to just to maintain.
Yeah. And I feel like maintaining requires a lot of very assertive, determined actions that, whereas the French Laundry, you were sort of growing into what it was going to take. You were still finding your personality. And when I say you, I meant the restaurant.
Right.
And so it was more of a gradual assimilation versus, you know, you're getting thrown into the ocean like it was at Charlie's.
So how is Chef Keller in the kitchen, you know, given that he's still kind of ascending and figuring out what he's doing?
Chef Keller was, he was there leading by example every minute. Like, again, Charlie had, literally the year that I started, was named the best restaurant in the country by Wine Spectator. And nobody knew about the French Laundry. So Thomas had a lot to prove. He had a big chip on his shoulder. They put up a tremendous amount of financial risk. That, so there's a lot of pressure to build and achieve. So he was there every second of every day and was physically cooking. I mean, that was one thing that I never saw Chef Schroeder do, was cook.
Right. I was going to say that's a big contrast because
yeah.
Chef Trotter at that point really was never on the line from what I understand.
Right.
And it sounds like, you know, Chef Keller and, you know, and you obviously, when I've seen you in the kitchen, you do a lot of cooking too.
Yeah.
So it's a different kind of, you know, there are a lot of different interpretations of what chef means.
Right. And leadership. Right. And I think they were both, those are two very different styles that were both very effective in their own way.
Yeah, when I talked to Trotter about it years ago, you know, he'd said, you know, at some point you graduate from being the first violin to the conductor. So I'm the conductor now. So that's how he saw himself.
Right. And you know what? Again, I never respected that up until about 7 years ago. And even when I respected it because I then understood it, I still didn't do it.
Right.
Up until maybe like right around now. So in the last year, I've been trying to wean myself away a little bit from the cutting board, but I'm not doing a very good job of it.
Right.
You know, I love to cook. And a lot of times people talk about having an R&D kitchen where you can lock yourself away in this romantic studio kitchen and have the freedom to create all day long. For me, that's not really how it works. I need to be in the environment that it's going to be served in and cooked in. I need to be able to turn around and have a dialogue with Doug or Catherine or Jared, you know, my second, third, and fourth hands. I need that product in my hand. And I also need to not know. I need to not have a plan, because often a farmer walks in the back door with something we didn't order because he thought we might find it interesting, and I grab a hold of it. Those are the times that your creativity pours out.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
That's that improvisation stuff that Trotter was into.
Yeah, right. There's a rawness to it. There's a pureness that, if you write out a bunch of notes and you have a sketch, it's just not the same.
Right. So was Chef Keller like that too, or was he more about like, I'm going to nail down these dishes and I'm going to get like the perfect combination of dishes for this restaurant, as opposed to we're just going to do something different every day and see what works and what doesn't?
So we did both there. A lot of people don't realize that the menu changed every day at the French Laundry too. In fact, that was a major philosophy of that restaurant. But the difference is with the French Laundry is you had an ever-growing Rolodex of dishes. So if at Trotter's one day you would have saddle of lamb with morels and English peas, and then the next day you came in and it was saddle of lamb with braised lamb tongue and collard greens, it was the same protein prepared the same way with the same sauce, and two garnishes were changed.
Right.
Whereas at French Laundry, it would be, if you're on the fish station, you would have a lobster with mac and cheese on Monday, and then when you come in the next day, it would be a lobster with peas and carrots. So they were very different dishes because they were cohesively conceptual, and then they would plug in every day.
What was it about the French Laundry that worked for you in a way that Trotter's did not?
I feel like because the French Laundry was just becoming known, it was kind of slow when I started there. So Trotter's was every day 150 to 180 covers, like a lightning bolt or a rocket ship taking off every day.
He talked that way too. Like he talked really fast. Like yeah. I had to, the yeah. reason I have like such good quotes from him, my stories from the Tribune way back when, was because unlike with a lot of them, I would record my conversations with him because I could not keep up.
Yeah, he was fast. So it felt like there was more focus on the cooking. There was more mentoring. Thomas would come in and literally show you how to break down a fish by putting a cutting board directly next to yours and filleting one for you himself, and then watching you do it and correcting you in real time. And so there was a stronger emphasis on that. There was just more time to spend with the food. And then that eventually changed, but it was in lockstep with my development and my confidence and my ability. So as the restaurant got more popular and more accolades and higher demands, I was able to keep up with that because I was growing with it.
And how long were you there total?
5 years.
So it's a lot of growth over that time.
A lot of growth.
I mean, you came in as one chef and went out as a different one, I would assume. I mean, it's still you, yeah. But came out with a vision of maybe what you wanted to do on your own at that point.
Yeah, I had a pretty clear vision. And I took a year off in the middle there to make wine. And I think that was really helpful to make me realize that my place is in the kitchen. Like, winemaking was fun, it was interesting, but it was empty. Like, everything was empty without food.
Yeah. You could go join Nick and make some wine with
him.
Right.
Now we can make some wine, right.
So you left the French Laundry, you came to Evanston, you got that job at Trio. We've talked about that a bit. What was the first you heard from Charlie when you were back in Chicago, Evanston, all that?
Well, there was a pretty motivating quote in the New York Times. So Frank Bruni, the then critic of the Times, came in on night one.
To Alinea.
Yeah.
No, this I know is coming. I know what quote you're talking about.
Yeah. And
which was crazy, by the way, to come into night one of any restaurant.
Yeah, the New York Times food critic. I mean, that was rough. Anyway, so they reached out to Charlie for a quote, and he said it's a marathon, not a sprint. He felt like we were nonsense upon stilts.
That was the quote, nonsense upon stilts. I wrote that down.
Yeah, and he literally said, call me back in 10 years or something like that. And, you know, that was the first I heard of him. And then...
So when you were a trio, you never heard from him?
I did. He made a reservation once, but then they canceled it. And I remember...
They canceled. They didn't just no-show.
They canceled. Okay. They canceled. But that was nerve-wracking, trying to think about what to serve him there. I forgot. When I was at the French Laundry, he came in to eat there.
Oh.
And, yeah, I forgot about this. So I was in the kitchen that night, and everybody was really nervous and excited. After the meal, he came back. And Thomas, after in mid-conversation, turned around and gestured to me with his hand and said, "Oh, well, you know Grant." And Charlie just sort of cocked his head like he used to do, right? And just sort of looked at me blankly, turned back around to Thomas, and just continued the conversation.
Wow.
Didn't acknowledge that he knew me. Now, maybe he didn't. Maybe he didn't remember. I bet he probably did. And then there was the New York Times article. But then we did a couple of events there. I got sick, and there was a party at his house that he invited me to, and then made some really, really nice speeches at that party about me. And obviously, I was going through treatment then, and everybody in the city was there. Paul Kahn, Rick Bayless, Terry Nahabedian, everybody was there. And he just said some really nice things. And then after that, like I mentioned, there would be letters he would send me, which is pretty hilarious because we're like a 7-minute walk.
Yeah, you're right down the block.
But I appreciated it. Congratulating us on some of the milestones and accolades that we made.
Did he ever come in here and eat a meal?
He did not. No. He came close once where he was throwing an event, and I feel like there were chefs from all over the world. I think like Andoni from Movies was up there, and maybe Juan Rocha, and they were trying to come in after the event. But they ended up running way, way late, and it was like 11 o'clock, and we weren't open. But yeah, they never came in.
And Michelin came to town, and Lenny got 3 stars, and Trotters got 2.
2011.
Yeah.
First one that was released here in Chicago. Man, that was a time. That was... the most like energy in this restaurant. The whole city was crackling, right? So you had us being, you know, now open for 6 years. You had, well, I don't remember if Curtis was still at Avenues or if he was at Grace at that point. Graham Elliott Bowles might have been at Avenues and Curtis might have been, I don't know. And then Charlie, obviously, and those were the ones that were in contention for the 3-star mark. And yeah, I remember when it finally came out, I had a lot of emotions over that. Obviously I was elated that we had 3, but I was sad for him, and because I knew how much it meant.
Right.
He would always talk about Freddy Girardet and the Michelin 3 stars in Europe and how they were so awesome and we should aspire to be them.
And these are the places that were kind of disappointing to you when you actually went over there.
Yeah, which is weird.
Did you think the Trotters would get 3 stars at that point?
Honestly, I feel like I was probably about 50-50. I think everybody sort of felt like... it was starting to age a bit and show its age. And so people were uncertain about how Michelin would react to that. It had been an anchor here in Chicago for so many years. And without, and nobody can question the fact that shortly after they opened, they were operating as a Michelin three-star restaurant for many, many, many years.
Right.
And so it was, it, I think everybody was like, who knows how this is going to go? And I felt really bad. And despite that, because everybody knew it hit him hard, right? But despite that, he sent me a letter and congratulated us on the Michelin stars and everything that we were doing for the city. And he was so proud. And
nice.
Yeah, it really was.
One of the things that's striking about the Trotter's menu that you're doing in Next, and maybe this kind of factors into that Michelin thing, is that, again, it's this like totally delicious, you know, wonderful meal. But in terms of like what he was doing, he was so ahead of the curve in, you know, the way he dealt with vegetables, the way he dealt with, you know, reductions mm-hmm. and flavor combinations and all of these things, wine pairings. And so much of what he did, and this is what you were talking about earlier about, you know, giving credit or not getting credit, it was adopted by the wider fine dining world.
Right.
So that when you ate at Trotter's at that point in 2011, and when you're eating the next thing now, you're blown away by how wonderful it tastes, but you're not blown away by how, you know, unlike everything else in the world it is.
Right.
It feels like he sort of set the template that almost the majority of fine dining restaurants follow. I mean, so many people now say, oh, we're farm to table and we get the right. freshest ingredients and right. we combine the freshest, like all the things that were his mantra before people were doing them is like so many other chefs' mantra. And I wonder if it's sort of, he sort of suffered from the fact that he was so influential that what he did became, you know, more, you know, widespread.
Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of factors there that people don't consider. So we spoke about him being the conductor, right? And in order to get credit in the industry has to like you and they have to respect you. And I'm not saying that they didn't respect Charlie fully, because there's nobody in this business that can look at that restaurant, that man, and say, he wasn't that good, or they weren't that good. But the fact that he didn't cook on a daily basis, I think made a lot of chefs dismiss him or feel like, I mean, it happens now, right? Like people are like, "Oh, you didn't earn your chops," you know.
And he come in like just. I mean, he opened that restaurant. The part of what was amazing about his story is that he didn't have the training that you had when he opened Trotter's,
right? And that probably works to his advantage, right? Because he was probably like, "Hey, there are no rules. I can do a mind pairing. I don't have to follow the template that the French chefs laid down, heavily reducing their sauces, a lot of butter and cream, throwing luxury ingredients on everything." So that naivete probably helped him.
Right. The tomato soup, by the way, what was it? The tomato water? Like, how is that? Like, that was amazing.
Literally every single person that comes into this menu is like, that tomato soup. And every single person's right, because that is, it blew me away when we put it up, when Chef Allen and I were hovering over some of the R&D stuff. It's unbelievable that we can get that flavor out of tomatoes and have it feel so bright and fresh with such a silky texture. Cilantro avocado sorbet. I mean, come on. Who was doing that then, right? So it checked all of the boxes.
But like, tell me how you get that water, because it's the server was talking about it, and it just sounded like a much more elaborate thing than you would realize. Like, you're not just putting it in a juicer here.
No. I mean, you have to puree the tomatoes and hang them in cheesecloth. Sometimes you can freeze it and let it drip clarify. So it drips like coffee, right? Through a filter so fine that all of the particulate stays in the cheesecloth and only the essence of that tomato drips out. So when you blend a tomato into a soup, you have to add some liquid to get the right consistency. Most people would just add water. But in Charlie's mind, water's going to dilute the tomato flavor, so we have to dilute the tomato with tomato.
Right.
Right? And that makes sense.
In going back to any of these dishes, did you learn anything? Like, did you get ideas for stuff that you would do in Alinea or any of that?
Yeah, for sure. It was a reminder of flavor combinations, in some cases ingredients that I forgot that I love so much because I haven't used them in so long. None of them have been implemented up here yet, but we will. I have them all written down. The process is really fun because, for the most part, I haven't flipped through cookbooks as part of the creative process anymore.
Right.
I used to do that a lot. But this was, in effect, paging through Charlie's books, making this menu. It was a lot of inspiration for stuff that we will do or techniques that we haven't done in a while.
Did all these recipes come from cookbooks? Originally?
Yeah. All of them were from the books, and I think three or four of them were from dishes that were on the menu when I was there.
Which were the dishes that you revisited that you prepared when you were there?
The cannelloni for one. The caviar with sea urchin was one that I helped do. It wasn't on my station, but station adjacent. The sea bass with the carrots and the chanterelles we talked about.
Right.
The salmon that I prepared for the tryout. And now that I'm, again, just having another memory, one thing that I did the night before the stage tryout, I ate at the restaurant.
Okay.
By myself. So here I am, my 21-year-old self in a frumpy, way oversized suit from JCPenney, probably. Because I wanted to look at what ingredients that was in the kitchen so that I might have an idea of what they would put in the mystery box. Mm-hmm. So I was sort of get ahead of it. I wanted to look at all his plateware. I wanted to look at the aesthetic of how he enjoyed plating the food so I could mirror that. And I had that sea bass dish that night that I ate. And then basically replicated it with salmon for the tryout. And now that sea bass dish is on the menu.
Wow. So that's full circle. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Did you, when you were preparing this stuff, would you call in like Matthias Merges or Bill Kim or Giuseppe Tentori and mm-hmm. say, hey, come try this. Tell me if this tastes like you remember.
Did not do that, but prior to making the final decision on whether we would do the Sommage menu, I tested them. And I was like, you know, obviously, Chef Trotter isn't here. I can't ask his permission, but I want yours. I mean, I think Matthias was there for like 14 years or something. Yeah. So it was very much their, as much their food as it was Trotter's. And so out of respect, I felt like I had to get their permission, especially because I only worked there for 4 months, right? So I just wanted to have the blessing there. Obviously, his son, Dylan, we asked, and he has been so helpful. Like, memorabilia, he came in and talked to the staff and, you know, gave us anecdotal stories about his father that we would have never known. And I think it was really important because it's easy to talk about exaggerations of people's personality when you're able to focus on maybe the negative aspects and you never hear the good stuff, right? And so some of the stories that Dylan told us about his generosity, his charitable efforts, and honestly, him as a father, they were pretty mind-blowing and pretty impressive. And so that really balanced everything out for the front of the house to make it easier for them to explain the story.
That must have been emotional for him too, to be sort of have this come full circle where he can come into this, you know, kitchen that was, you know, at least a peer of what his father was doing, and they're going to try to do pay homage to what his dad was doing and do it right.
Yeah, it was so. On night one, it would have been Charlie's 65th birthday.
Oh wow!
And that was just by pure coincidence, which was really weird, right? So Dylan brought in Bill Fiam, Giuseppe Tintori, Chef Farmerly Jones from the Chef's Garden, who was right. really, really close with Charlie. Charlie's mom, his brothers and sisters, his ex-wife, and Dylan. And it was really emotional.
Wow.
You know, they were tasting and smelling his food for the first time in a long time. A lot of memories, a lot of stories, and it was his birthday. So, like, there was a lot going on there, and it felt so rewarding to be able to provide that for them, something that I have never been able to be a part of, something so monumental for people. It was a different level of hospitality. It was a different level of giving,
right?
Basically.
Has doing this also kind of closed a book for you, where I mean you obviously had very mixed feelings about your experience at Trotter's and with Trotter, and
yeah.
this is sort of closing the book in a different way, like giving it an ending that puts everything in perspective, that feels a little better, maybe.
Yeah, it feels way better. We had a very complicated relationship that was tumultuous and angsty and competitive in the beginning. And then as I got older, more mature, and more experienced in running a restaurant and what that entailed, I started to have a lot of respect for him. And even those actions that back then came off as mean, I started to understand. And then with his reaching out later in his life, and I mean, dare I say, you know, befriending me a little bit. Like, I feel like we were starting to become not just colleagues, but friends at the end. And then I regret, like you mentioned, has he ever eaten here? And no, that would have been amazing, right? And having him still up the street operating that restaurant would have been powerful for us in the city. And because we don't have that opportunity now, this felt like the right way, as you're saying, to bookend it and close that chapter.
Right. He never apologized for the nonsense upon stilts quote, I assume.
No.
He never brought it up, or you didn't bring it up. Never, like, hey, man, what did you ever say to him, come on, what was that?
No. We had not became that close at the end. That would have had, maybe now, that would have been something that we should have talked about.
Right. Yeah, since you made it past your 10 years.
Right.
You're still at that level.
Right.
Dylan gave you those plates for that appetizer with the caviar and the sea urchin, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the tea on them.
And that's what I mean by Dylan's generosity and willingness to do this. You know, I'm sure it was not a particularly easy decision for him, both in terms of having another chef or operator recreate your father's iconic food. There's a lot of room for failure there and potentially, like, sort of tarnishing that image and not upholding the legacy that deserves to be upheld. But also there's a lot of emotional excavating for him, you know, and we're talking now about doing a couple of events at Trotter's.
Because that place still exists. Say they never sold it.
I was in there not too long ago, and it just gives you goosebumps. It's crazy.
Does it look the same? I mean, have you done anything with it? Or
it looks exactly the same, but you know how if you say go back to a childhood home or your childhood high school,
it's all smaller.
It feels tiny. And that's how
that kitchen was pretty small. And you like you have more spacious proportions here than you did there.
Right. But man, when I walked in there, it felt like we were in a cave. It was weird. It was really weird.
Did you have like flashbacks? Did you start getting PTSD?
No PTSD, but even the smell.
Interesting. You know?
The way the stairs creaked as you stepped on them when you were going up. Stuff like that. It was powerful.
Wow.
Yeah.
Someone sent me something that he's maybe going to turn it into a bar.
Yeah. I don't know what he's working on right now. He definitely is trying to activate it in some way. And so that's why it came up like, hey, why don't we move the pop-up over there? Why don't we do it in the space? Maybe invite alumni back and have them in that building. And
so this pop-up that you're working on is going to be at Trotters?
We would love to do it there. And we've been talking to Dylan about it.
So you'll do this menu there?
Yeah. Yeah.
And have like special, you could do New Year's Eve there.
Yeah.
Because that was where he announced that he was closing, was his New Year's Eve thing.
Right. You know, and so it was a lot of fun to provide the opportunity for like you to come in and have that meal. I invited Phil Vitale. He's coming in.
Nice.
A lot of local chefs have come in. The menu is incredibly busy because people want an opportunity to have something they would never be able to have again.
Absolutely.
And it's an honor to be able to do that.
That's all for episode 156 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Grant Atkins for letting us re-experience Charlie Trotter's cooking at Next Restaurant's Charlie Trotter menu, and for offering such a deep personal and professional perspective on the late chef. The Next Charlie Trotter menu runs through January 12th, and you can learn more and book a table at nextrestaurant.com. I also recommend Rebecca Halpern's documentary Love Charlie, now available on Netflix, and not just because Chef Atkins and I are both in it. She does an excellent job showing Charlie Trotter's brilliance and generosity, as well as the more difficult aspects of his personality. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, a master of the audio tasting menu. If you've gotten this far, you must like Caropop, right? Any chance you can support us? For mere $24, you could become a Caropop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at caropop.com. We appreciate you all. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Caropop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at CarolPopcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCarro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.